This is Audible.
Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, written by Nir Eyal, with Ryan Hoover, narrated by Dave Wright. Introduction. 79% of smartphone owners check their device within 15 minutes of waking up every morning. Perhaps more startling, fully one-third of Americans say they would rather give up sex than lose their cell phones. A 2011 university study suggested people check their phones 34 times per day. However, industry insiders believe that number is closer to an astounding 150 daily sessions. Face it, we're hooked. The technologies we use have turned into compulsions, if not full-fledged addictions. It's the impulse to check a message notification. It's the pull to visit YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter for just a few minutes, only to find yourself still tapping and scrolling an hour later. It's the urge you likely feel throughout your day but hardly notice. Cognitive psychologists define habits as automatic behaviors triggered by situational cues, things we do with little or no conscious thought. The products and services we use habitually alter our everyday behavior just as their designers intended. Our actions have been engineered. How do companies producing little more than bits of code displayed on a screen seemingly control users' minds? What makes some products so habit-forming? Forming habits is imperative for the survival of many products. As infinite distractions compete for our attention, companies are learning to master novel tactics to stay relevant in users' minds. Amassing millions of users is no longer good enough. Companies increasingly find that their economic value is a function of the strength of the habits they create. In order to win the loyalty of their users and create a product that's regularly used, companies must learn not only what compels users to click, but also what makes them tick. Although the companies are just waking up to this new reality, others are already cashing in. By mastering habit-forming product design, the companies profiled in this book make their goods indispensable. First to mind wins. Companies that form strong user habits enjoy several benefits to their bottom line. These companies attach their product to internal triggers. As a result, users show up without any external prompting. Instead of relying on expensive marketing, habit-forming companies link their services to the user's daily routines and emotions. A habit is at work when users feel a tad bored and instantly open Twitter. They feel a pang of loneliness, and before rational thought occurs, they're scrolling through their Facebook feeds. A question comes to mind, and before searching their brains, they query Google. The first-to-mind solution wins. In Chapter 1 of this book, we explore the competitive advantages of habit-forming products. How do products create habits? The answer? They manufacture them. While fans of the television show Mad Men are familiar with how the ad industry once created consumer desire during Madison Avenue's golden era, those days are long gone. A multi-screen world of ad-wary consumers has rendered Don Draper's big-budget brainwashing useless to all but the biggest brands. Today, small startup teams can profoundly change behavior by guiding users through a series of experiences I call hooks. The more often users run through these hooks, the more likely they are to form habits. How I got hooked. In 2008, I was among a team of Stanford MBAs starting a company backed by some of the brightest investors in Silicon Valley. Our mission was to build a platform for placing advertising into the booming world of online social games. Notable companies were making hundreds of millions of dollars selling virtual cows on digital farms, while advertisers were spending huge sums of money to influence people to buy whatever they were peddling. I admit, I didn't get it at first and found myself standing at the water's edge wondering, how do they do it? At the intersection of these two industries dependent on mind manipulation, I embarked upon a journey to learn how products change our actions and, at times, create compulsions. How did these companies engineer user behavior? What were the moral implications of building potentially addictive products? Most important, could the same forces that made these experiences so compelling also be used to build products to improve people's lives? Where could I find the blueprints for forming habits? To my disappointment, I found no guide. Businesses skilled in behavior design guarded their secrets, and although I uncovered books, white papers, and blog posts tangentially related to the topic, there was no how-to manual for building habit-forming products. I began documenting my observation of hundreds of companies to uncover patterns in user experience designs and functionality. Although every business had its unique flavor, I sought to identify the commonalities behind the winners and understand what was missing among the losers. I looked for insights from academia drawing upon consumer psychology, human-computer interaction, and behavioral economics research. In 2011, I began sharing what I learned and started working as a consultant to a host of Silicon Valley companies, from small startups to Fortune 500 enterprises. Each client provided an opportunity to test my theories, draw new insights, and refine my thinking. I began blogging about what I learned at nearandfar.com, and my essays were syndicated to other sites. Readers soon began writing in with their own observations and examples. In the fall of 2012, Dr. Baba Shiv and I designed and taught a class at the Stanford Graduate School of Business on the science of influencing human behavior. The next year, I partnered with Dr. Steph Habif to teach a similar course at the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design. These years of distilled research and real-world experience resulted in the creation of the Hook Model, a four-phase process companies use to form habits. Through consecutive hook cycles, successful products reach their ultimate goal of unprompted user engagement, bringing users back repeatedly without depending on costly advertising or aggressive messaging. While I draw many examples from technology companies, given my industry background, hooks are everywhere, in apps, sports, movies, games, and even our jobs. Hooks can be found in virtually any experience that burrows into our minds, and often our wallets. The four steps of the hook model provide the framework for the chapters of this book. 1. Trigger. A trigger is the actuator of behavior, the spark plug in the engine. Triggers come in two types, external and internal. Habit-forming products start by alerting users with external triggers, like an email, a website link, or the app icon on a phone. For example, suppose Barbara, a young woman in Pennsylvania, happens to see a photo in her Facebook news feed taken by a family member from a rural part of the state. It's a lovely picture, and because she is planning a trip there with her brother Johnny, the external triggers call to action, in marketing and advertising lingo, intrigues her and she clicks. By cycling through successive hooks, users begin to form associations with internal triggers, which attach to existing behaviors and emotions. When users start to automatically cue their next behavior, the new habit becomes part of their everyday routine. Over time, Barbara associates Facebook with her need for social connection. Chapter 2 explores external and internal triggers, answering the question of how product designers determine which triggers are most effective. 2. Action. Following the trigger comes the action, the behavior done in anticipation of a reward. The simple action of clicking on the interesting picture in her news feed takes Barbara to a website called Pinterest, a social bookmarking site with a virtual pin board. This phase of the hook, as described in Chapter 3, draws upon the art and science of usability design to reveal how products drive specific user actions. Companies leverage two basic pulleys of human behavior to increase the likelihood of an action occurring: the ease of performing an action, and the psychological motivation to do it. Once Barbara completes the simple action of clicking on the photo, she is dazzled by what she sees next. 3. Variable reward. What distinguishes the hook model from a plain vanilla feedback loop is the hook's ability to create a craving, Feedback loops are all around us, but predictable ones don't create desire. The unsurprising response of your fridge light turning on when you open the door doesn't drive you to keep opening it again and again. However, add some variability to the mix. Suppose a different treat magically appears in your fridge every time you open it, and voila, intrigue is created. Variable rewards are one of the most powerful tools companies implement to hook users. Chapter 4 explains them in further detail. Research shows that levels of the neurotransmitter dopamine surge when the brain is expecting a reward. Introducing variability multiplies the effect, creating a focus state, which suppresses the areas of the brain associated with judgment and reason while activating the parts associated with wanting and desire. Although classic examples include slot machines and lotteries, variable rewards are prevalent in many other habit-forming products. When Barbara lands on Pinterest, not only does she see the image she intended to find, but she is also served a multitude of other glittering objects. The images are related to what she is generally interested in, namely things to see on her upcoming trip to rural Pennsylvania. But there are other things that catch her eye as well. The exciting juxtaposition of relevant and irrelevant, tantalizing and plain, beautiful and common, sets her brain's dopamine system aflutter with the promise of reward. Now she's spending more time on Pinterest, hunting for the next wonderful thing to find. Before she knows it, she spent 45 minutes scrolling. Chapter 4 also explores why some people eventually lose their taste for certain experiences and how variability impacts their retention. 4. Investment. The last phase of the hook model is where the user does a bit of work. The investment phase increases the odds that the user will make another pass through the hook cycle in the future. The investment occurs when the user puts something into the product of service such as time, data, effort, social capital, or money. However, the investment phase isn't about users opening up their wallets and moving on with their day. Rather, the investment implies an action that improves the service for the next go-around. Inviting friends, stating preferences, building virtual assets, and learning to use new features are all investments users make to improve their experience. These commitments can be leveraged to make the trigger more engaging, the action easier, and the reward more exciting with every pass through the hook cycle. Chapter 5 delves into how investments encourage users to cycle through successive hooks. As Barbara enjoys endlessly scrolling through the Pinterest cornucopia, she builds a desire to keep the things that delight her. By collecting items, she gives the site data about her preferences. Soon, she will follow, pin, repin, and make other investments, which serve to increase her ties to the site and prime her for future loops through the hook. A new superpower. Habit-forming technology is already here, and it is being used to mold our lives. The fact that we have greater access to the web through our various connected devices, smartphones and tablets, televisions, game consoles, and wearable technology, gives companies far greater ability to affect our behavior. As companies combine their increased connectivity to consumers with the ability to collect, mine, and process consumer data at faster speeds, we are faced with a future where everything becomes potentially more habit-forming. As famed Silicon Valley investor Paul Graham writes, "Unless the forms of technological progress that produce these things are subject to different laws than technological progress in general, the world will get more addictive in the next 40 years than it did in the last 40. Chapter 6 explores this new reality and discusses the morality of manipulation. Recently, a blog reader emailed me, "If it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower." He's right. And under this definition, building habit-forming products is indeed a superpower. If used irresponsibly, bad habits can quickly degenerate into mindless, zombie-like addictions. Did you recognize Barbara and her brother Johnny from the previous example? Zombie film buffs likely did. They are characters from the classic horror flick Night of the Living Dead, a story about people possessed by a mysterious force which compels their every action. No doubt you've noticed the resurgence of the zombie genre over the past several years. Games like Resident Evil, television shows like The Walking Dead, and movies including World War Z are a testament to the creature's growing appeal. But why are zombies suddenly so fascinating? Perhaps technology's unstoppable progress, ever more pervasive and persuasive, has grabbed us in a fearful malaise at the thought of being involuntarily controlled. Although the fear is palpable, we are like the heroes in every zombie film, threatened but ultimately more powerful. I have come to learn that habit-forming products can do far more good than harm. Choice architecture, a concept described by famed scholars Thaler, Sunstein, and Balls in their same-titled scholarly paper, offers techniques to influence people's decisions and affect behavioral outcomes. Ultimately, though, the practice should be used to help nudge people to make better choices, as judged by themselves. Accordingly, this book teaches innovators how to build products to help people do the things they already want to do, but, for lack of a solution, don't do. Hooked seems to unleash the tremendous new powers innovators and entrepreneurs have to influence the everyday lives of billions of people. I believe the trinity of access, data, and speed presents unprecedented opportunities to create positive habits. When harnessed correctly, technology can enhance lives through healthful behaviors that improve our relationships, make us smarter, and increase productivity. The Hook model explains the rationale behind the design of many successful habit-forming products and services we use daily. Although not exhaustive given the vast amount of academic literature available, the model is intended to be a practical tool rather than a theoretical one made for entrepreneurs and innovators who aim to use habits for good. In this book, I have compiled the most relevant research, shared actionable insights, and provided a practical framework designed to increase the innovator's odds of success. Hooks connect the user's problem with a company's solution frequently enough to form a habit. My goal is to provide you with a deeper understanding of how certain products change what we do and, by extension, who we are. How to use this book. At the end of each section, you'll find a few bulleted takeaways. Reviewing them, jotting them down in a notebook, or sharing them on a social network is a great way to pause, reflect, and reinforce what you have read. Building a habit-forming product yourself? If so, the Do This Now sections at the end of subsequent chapters will help guide your next steps. Remember and share. Habits are defined as behaviors done with little or no conscious thought. The convergence of access, data, and speed is making the world a more habit-forming place. Businesses that create customer habits gain a significant competitive advantage. The Hook model describes an experience designed to connect the user's problem to a solution frequently enough to form a habit. The Hook model has four phases: trigger, action, variable reward, and investment. Chapter 1. The Habit Zone. When I run, I zone out. I don't think about what my body is doing, and my mind usually wanders elsewhere. I find it relaxing and refreshing and run about 3 mornings each week. Recently, I needed to take an overseas client call during my usual morning run time. No biggie, I thought. I can run in the evening instead. However, the time shift created some peculiar behaviors that night. I left the house for my run at dusk, and as I was about to pass a woman taking out her trash, she made eye contact and smiled. I politely saluted her with, "Good morning," and then caught my mistake. "I mean, good evening. Sorry." I corrected myself, realizing I was about 10 hours off. She furrowed her brow and cracked a nervous smile. Slightly embarrassed, I noted how my mind had been oblivious to the time of day. I chided myself not to do it again, but within a few minutes I passed another runner, and again, as if possessed, I blurted out, "Good morning." What was going on? Back home during my normal post-run shower, my mind began to wander again, as it often does when I bathe. My brain's autopilot switch turned on, and I proceeded with my daily routine, unaware of my actions. It wasn't until I felt the nick of the razor cutting my face that I realized I had lathered up and started shaving. Although it is something I do every morning, shaving was painfully unnecessary in the evening, and yet I'd done it anyway, unknowingly. The evening version of my morning run had triggered a behavioral script that instructed my body to carry out my usual run-related activities, all within mindful awareness. Such is the nature of ingrained habits, behaviors done with little or no conscious thought, which, by some estimates, guide nearly half of our daily actions. Habits are one of the ways the brain learns complex behaviors. Neuroscientists believe habits give us the ability to focus our attention on other things by storing automatic responses in the basal ganglia, an area of the brain associated with involuntary actions. Habits form when the brain takes a shortcut and stops actively deliberating over what to do next. The brain quickly learns to codify behaviors that provide a solution to whatever situation it encounters. For example, nail biting is a common behavior that occurs with little or no conscious thought. Initially, the biter might start chomping on her fingernail for a reason, to remove an unsightly hangnail, for example. However, when the behavior occurs for no conscious purpose, simply as an automatic response to a cue, the habit is in control. For many persistent nail biters, the unconscious trigger is the unpleasant feeling of stress. The more the biter associates the act of nail chomping with the temporary relief it provides, the harder it becomes to change the conditioned response. Like nail biting, many of our daily decisions are made simply because that was the way we have found resolution in the past. The brain automatically deduces that if the decision was a good one yesterday, then it is a safe bet again today, and the action becomes a routine. On my run, my brain had associated making eye contact with another person during my run with a standard good morning greeting. Thus, I automatically uttered these words, no matter how inappropriately timed. Why habits are good for business. If our program behaviors are so influential in guiding our everyday actions, surely harnessing the same power of habits can be a boon for industry. Indeed, for those able to shape them in an effective way, habits can be very good for the bottom line. Habit-forming products change user behavior and create unprompted user engagement. The aim is to influence customers to use your product on their own again and again without relying on overt calls to action such as ads or promotions. Once a habit is formed, the user is automatically triggered to use the product during routine events such as wanting to kill time while waiting in line. However, the framework and practices explored in this book are not one size fits all and do not apply to every business or industry. Entrepreneurs should evaluate how user habits impact their particular business model and goals. While the viability of some products depends on habit formation to thrive, that is not always the case. For example, companies selling infrequently bought or used products or services do not require habitual users, at least not in the sense of everyday engagement. Life insurance companies, for instance, leverage salespeople, advertising, and word-of-mouth referrals and recommendations to prompt consumers to buy policies. Once the policy is bought, there is nothing more the customer needs to do. In this book, I refer to products in the context of businesses that require ongoing, unprompted user engagement and therefore need to build user habits. I exclude companies that compel customers to take action through other means. Before diving into the mechanics of how habits are made, we must first understand their general importance and competitive benefits for businesses. Habit formation is good for business in several ways. Increasing customer lifetime value. MBAs are taught that a business is worth the sum of its future profits. This benchmark is how investors calculate the fair price of a company's shares. CEOs and their management teams are evaluated by their ability to increase the value of their stocks, and therefore care deeply about the ability of their companies to generate free cash flow. Management's job, in the eyes of shareholders, is to implement strategies to grow future profits by increasing revenues or decreasing expenses. Fostering consumer habits is an effective way to increase the value of a company by driving higher customer lifetime value, CLTV, the amount of money made from a customer before that person switches to a competitor, stops using the product, or dies. User habits increase how long and how frequently customers use a product, resulting in higher CLTV. Some products have a very high CLTV. For example, credit card customers tend to stay loyal for a very long time and are worth a bundle. Hence, credit card companies are willing to spend a considerable amount of money acquiring new customers. This explains why you receive so many promotional offers ranging from free gifts to airline bonus miles to entice you to add another card or upgrade your current one. Your potential CLTV justifies a credit card company's marketing investment. Providing pricing flexibility. Renowned investor and Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett once said, "You can determine the strength of a business over time by the amount of agony they go through in raising prices." Buffett and his partner Charlie Munger realize that as customers form routines around a product, they come to depend on it and become less sensitive to price. The duo have pointed to consumer psychology as the rationale behind their famed investments in companies like See's Candies and Coca-Cola. Buffett and Munger understand that habits give companies greater flexibility to increase prices. For example, in the free-to-play video game business, it is standard practice for game developers to delay asking users to pay money until they have played consistently and habitually. Once the compulsion to play is in place and the desire to progress in the game increases, converting users into paying customers is much easier. The real money lies in selling virtual items, extra lives, and special powers. As of December 2013, more than 500 million people have downloaded Candy Crush Saga, a game played mostly on mobile devices. The game's freemium model converts some of those users into paying customers, netting the game's maker nearly $100 million per day. This pattern also applies to other services. For example, take Evernote, the popular note-taking and archiving software. It is free to use, but the company offers upgraded features such as offline viewing and collaboration tools for a price which many devoted users are happy to pay. Evernote CEO Phil Leiben shared some revealing insights about how the company turns non-paying users into revenue-generating ones. In 2011, Leiben published a chart now known as the Smile Graph. With the percentage of sign-ups represented on the Y-axis and time spent on the service on the X-axis, the chart showed that although usage plummeted at first, it rocketed upward as people formed a habit of using the service. The resulting down and up curve gave the chart its emblematic smile shape, and Evernote's CEO a matching grin. In addition, as usage increased over time, so did customers' willingness to pay. Leiben noted that after the first month, only 0.5% of users paid for the service. However, this rate gradually increased. By month 33, 11% of users had started paying. At month 42, a remarkable 26% of customers were paying for something they had previously used for free. Supercharging growth. Users who continuously find value in a product are more likely to tell their friends about it. Frequent usage creates more opportunities to encourage people to invite their friends, broadcast content, and share through word of mouth. Hooked users become brand evangelists, megaphones for your company, bringing in new users at little or no cost. Products with higher user engagement also have the potential to grow faster than their rivals. Case in point, Facebook leapfrogged its competitors, including MySpace and Friendster, even though it was relatively late to the social networking party. Although its competitors both had healthy growth rates and millions of users by the time Mark Zuckerberg's fledgling site launched beyond the closed doors of academia, his company came to dominate the industry. Facebook's success was in part a result of what I call the more is more principle. More frequent usage drives more viral growth. As David Skock, tech entrepreneur turned venture capitalist, points out, the most important factor to increasing growth is viral cycle time. Viral cycle time is the amount of time it takes a user to invite another user, and it can have a massive impact. For example, after 20 days with a cycle time of 2 days, you will have 20,470 users. Skock writes, "But if you have that cycle time to 1 day, you would have over 20 million users. It is logical that it would be better to have more cycles occur, but it is less obvious just how much better. Having a greater proportion of users daily returning to a service dramatically decreases viral cycle time for two reasons. First, daily users initiate loops more often. Think tagging a friend in a Facebook photo. Second, more daily active users means more people to respond and react to each invitation. The cycle not only perpetuates the process with higher and higher usage engagement, it accelerates it." Sharpening the competitive edge. User habits are a competitive advantage. Products that change customer routines are less susceptible to attacks from other companies. Many entrepreneurs fall into the trap of building products that are only marginally better than existing solutions, hoping their innovation will be good enough to woo customers away from existing products. But when it comes to shaking consumers' old habits, these naive entrepreneurs often find that better products don't always win, especially if a large number of users have already adopted a competing product. A classic paper by John Gorville, a professor of marketing at Harvard Business School, stipulates that many innovations fail because consumers irrationally overvalue the old, while companies irrationally overvalue the new. Gorville claims that for new entrants to stand a chance, they can't just be better, they must be 9 times better. Why such a high bar? Because old habits die hard, and new products or services need to offer dramatic improvements to shake users out of old routines. Gorville writes that products that require a high degree of behavior change are doomed to fail even if the benefits of using the new product are clear and substantial. For example, the technology I am using to write this book is inferior to existing alternatives in many ways. I'm referring to the QWERTY keyboard, which was first developed in the 1870s for the now ancient typewriter. QWERTY was designed with commonly used characters spaced far apart. This layout prevented typists from jamming the metal type bars of early machines. This physical limitation is an anachronism in the digital age, yet QWERTY keyboards remain the standard despite the invention of far better layouts. Professor August Dvorak's keyboard design, for example, placed vowels in the center row, increasing typing speed and accuracy. Though patented in 1932, the Dvorak simplified keyboard was written off. QWERTY survives due to the high costs of changing user behavior. When first introduced to the keyboard, we used the hunt and peck method. After months of practice, we instinctively learned to activate all our fingers in response to our thoughts with little to no conscious effort, and the words begin to flow effortlessly from mind to screen. But switching to an unfamiliar keyboard, even if more efficient, would force us to relearn how to type. Fat chance. As we will learn in Chapter 5, users also increase their dependency on habit-forming products by storing value in them, further reducing the likelihood of switching to an alternative. For example, every email sent and received using Google's Gmail is stored indefinitely, providing users with a lasting repository of past conversations. New followers on Twitter increase users' clout and amplify their ability to transmit messages to their communities. Memories and experiences captured on Instagram are added to one's digital scrapbook. Switching to a new email service, social network, or photo sharing app becomes more difficult the more people use them. The non-transferable value created and stored inside these services discourages users from leaving. Ultimately, user habits increase a business's return on investment. Higher customer lifetime value, greater pricing flexibility, supercharged growth, and a sharpened competitive edge together equal a more powerful bang for the company's buck. Building the mind monopoly. While user habits are a boon to companies fortunate enough to engender them, their existence inherently makes success less likely for new innovations and startups trying to disrupt the status quo. The fact is that successfully changing long-term user habits is exceptionally rare. Altering behavior requires not only an understanding of how to persuade people to act, for example, the first time they land on a web page, but also necessitates getting them to repeat behaviors for long periods, ideally for the rest of their lives. Companies that succeed in building a habit-forming business are often associated with game-changing, wildly successful innovation. But like any discipline, habit design has rules and caveats that define and explain why some products change lives while others do not. For one, new behaviors have a short half-life, as our minds tend to revert to our old ways of thinking and doing. Experiments show that lab animals habituated to new behaviors tend to regress to their first learned behaviors over time. To borrow a term from accounting, behaviors are LIFO, last in, first out. In other words, the habits you've most recently acquired are also the ones most likely to go soonest. This helps explain the overwhelming evidence that people rarely change their habits for long. 2/3 of alcoholics who complete a rehabilitation program will pick up the bottle and their old habits within a year's time. Research shows that nearly everyone who loses weight on a diet gains back the pounds within 2 years. The enemy of forming new habits is past behaviors, and research suggests that old habits die hard. Even when we change our routines, neural pathways remain etched in our brains, ready to be reactivated when we lose focus. This presents an especially difficult challenge for product designers trying to create new lines or businesses based on forming new habits. For new behaviors to really take hold, they must occur often. In a recent study at the University College London, researchers followed participants as they attempted to form a habit of flossing their teeth. As one of its findings, the study concluded that the more frequently the new behavior occurred, the stronger the habit became. Like flossing, frequent engagement with a product, especially over a short period of time, increases the likelihood of forming new routines. Google Search provides an example of a service built upon a frequent behavior that helped create users' habits. If you're skeptical that Google is habit-forming, and you are a frequent Google user, just try using Bing. In a head-to-head comparison of the efficacy of an incognito search, the products are nearly identical. Even if the geniuses at Google have in fact perfected a faster algorithm, the time saved is imperceptible to everyone but robots and Mr. Spock. Milliseconds matter, but they don't hook users. So why haven't more Google users switched to Bing? Habits keep users loyal. If a user is familiar with the Google interface, switching to Bing requires cognitive effort. Although many aspects of Bing are similar to Google, even a slight change in pixel placement forces the would-be user to learn a new way of interacting with a site. Adapting to the differences in the Bing interface is what actually slows down regular Google users and makes Bing feel inferior, not the technology itself. Internet searches occur so frequently that Google is able to cement itself as the one and only solution in the habituated user's mind. Users no longer need to think about whether or not to use Google. They just do. Furthermore, whenever the company can identify the user through tracking technology, it improves search results based on past behaviors to deliver a more accurate and personalized experience, reinforcing the user's connection with the search engine. The more the product is used, the better the algorithm gets, and thus the more it is used. The result is a vicious cycle of habit-driven behavior resulting in Google's market domination. Habit as strategy. Sometimes a behavior does not occur as frequently as flossing or Googling, but it still becomes a habit. For an infrequent action to become a habit, the user must perceive a high degree of utility, either from gaining pleasure or avoiding pain. Take Amazon as an example. The e-tailer has its sights set on becoming the world's one-stop shop. Amazon is so confident in its ability to form user habits that it sells and runs ads for directly competitive products on its site. Customers often see the item they are about to buy listed at a cheaper price and can click away to transact elsewhere. To some, this sounds like a formula for disaster, but to Amazon, it is a shrewd business strategy. Not only does Amazon make money from the ads it runs from competing businesses, it also utilizes another company's marketing dollars to form a habit in the shopper's mind. Amazon seeks to become the solution to a frequently occurring pain point, the customer's desire to find the item they want. By addressing shoppers' price concerns, Amazon earns loyalty, even if it doesn't make the sale and comes across as trustworthy in the process. The tactic is backed by a 2003 study which demonstrated that consumers' preference for an online retailer increases when they are offered competitive price information. The technique has also been used by Progressive, the car insurance company, to drive over $15 billion of annual insurance sales, up from just $3.4 billion before the tactic was implemented. By allowing users to comparison shop from within the site, Amazon provides tremendous perceived utility from its customers. Although shopping on Amazon may not occur as frequently as searching on Google, the company solidifies its place as the default solution to customers' purchasing needs with each successful transaction. In fact, people are so comfortable comparison shopping on Amazon that they frequently use the company's mobile app to check prices when standing in the aisles of real stores, often making a purchase from inside a competing retailer. In the habit zone. A company can begin to determine its product's habit-forming potential by plotting two factors: frequency, how often the behavior occurs, and perceived utility, how useful and rewarding the behavior is in the user's mind over alternative solutions. Googling occurs multiple times per day, but any particular search is negligibly better than rival services like Bing. Conversely, using Amazon may be a less frequent occurrence, but users receive great value knowing they'll find whatever they need at the one and only Everything store. As represented in Figure 1, a behavior that occurs with enough frequency and perceived utility enters the habit zone, helping to make it a default behavior. If either of these factors falls short and the behavior lies below the threshold, it is less likely that the desired behavior will become a habit. Note that the line slopes downward but never quite reaches the perceived utility axis. Some behaviors never become habits because they do not occur frequently enough. No matter how much utility is involved, infrequent behaviors remain conscious actions and never create the automatic response that is characteristic of habits. On the other axis, however, even a behavior that provides minimal perceived benefit can become a habit simply because it occurs frequently. This concept is meant to be a guiding theory, and the scale of the illustration is intentionally left blank. Unfortunately for companies, research thus far has not found a universal timescale for turning all behaviors into habits. A 2010 study found that some habits can be formed in a matter of weeks, while others can take more than 5 months. The researchers also found that the complexity of the behavior and how important the habit was to the person greatly affected how quickly the routine was formed. There are few rules when it comes to answering how frequent is frequent enough, and the answer is likely specific to each business and behavior. However, as the previously mentioned flossing study demonstrates, we know that higher frequency is better. Think of the products and services you would identify as habit-forming. Most of these are used daily, if not multiple times per day. Let's explore why we use these products so frequently. Vitamins versus painkillers. It's never been easier to launch a new product or service, yet most new endeavors fail. Why? Products fail for a variety of reasons. Companies run out of funding. Products enter markets too early or too late. The marketplace doesn't need what companies are offering, or founders simply give up. Just as failure has many causes, success too can be attributed to a variety of factors. However, one aspect is common to all successful innovations. They solve problems. That may seem obvious, but understanding the kind of problem a new product solves can be a topic of much debate. Are you building a vitamin or painkiller is a common, almost cliched question many investors ask founders eager to cash their first venture capital check. The correct answer, from the perspective of most investors, is the latter, a painkiller. Likewise, innovators in companies big and small are constantly asked to prove their idea is important enough to merit the time and money needed to build it. Gatekeepers such as investors and managers want to invest in solving real problems or meeting immediate needs by backing painkillers. Painkillers solve an obvious need, relieving a specific pain, and often have quantifiable markets. Think Tylenol, the brand name version of acetaminophen, and the product's promise of reliable relief. It's the kind of ready-made solution for which people are happy to pay. Vitamins, by contrast, do not necessarily solve an obvious pain point. Instead, they appeal to users' emotional rather than functional needs. When we take our multivitamin each morning, we don't really know if it is actually making us healthier. In fact, recent evidence shows taking multivitamins may actually be doing more harm than good. But we don't really care, do we? Efficacy is not why we take vitamins. Taking a vitamin is a check-it-off-your-list behavior we measure in terms of psychological rather than physical relief. We feel satisfied that we are doing something good for our bodies, even if we can't tell how much good it is actually doing us. Unlike a painkiller, without which we cannot function, missing a few days of vitamin popping, say while on vacation, is no big deal. So perhaps managers and investors know best? Perhaps building painkillers, not vitamins, is always the right strategy. Not so fast. Let's consider a few of today's hottest consumer technology companies: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. What are they selling, vitamins or painkillers? Most people would guess vitamins, thinking users aren't doing much of anything important other than perhaps seeking a quick boost of social validation. After all, think back to before you first started using these services. No one ever woke up in the middle of the night screaming, "I need something to help me update my status." But like so many innovations, we did not know we needed them until they became part of our everyday lives. Before making up your mind on the vitamin versus painkiller debate for some of the world's most successful tech companies, consider this idea. A habit is when not doing an action causes a bit of pain. It is important to clarify that the term pain, as it is frequently used in business school and marketing books, is somewhat hyperbolic. In reality, the experience we are talking about is more similar to an itch, a feeling that manifests within the mind and causes discomfort until it is satisfied. The habit-forming products we use are simply there to provide some sort of relief. Using a technology or product to scratch the itch provides faster satisfaction than ignoring it. Once we become to depend on a tool, nothing else will do. My answer to the vitamin versus painkiller question? Habit-forming technologies are both. These services seem at first to be offering nice-to-have vitamins, but once the habit is established, they provide an ongoing pain remedy. Seeking pleasure and avoiding pain are two key motivators in all species. When we feel discomfort, we seek to escape the uncomfortable sensation. In the next chapter, we will explore how emotions, often negative ones, trigger users to reach for solutions. For now, the important thing to remember is that habit-forming products create associations in users' minds, and that the solution to their pain may be found in your product's use. We'll discuss the morality of manipulation in Chapter 8. However, it is worth noting that although some people use the terms interchangeably, habits are not the same things as addictions. The latter word means persistent, compulsive dependencies on a behavior or substance. Addictions, by definition, are self-destructive. Thus, it is irresponsible to make products that rely on creating and maintaining user addictions because doing so would mean intentionally harming people. A habit, on the other hand, is a behavior that can have a positive influence on a person's life. Habits can be healthy or unhealthy, and you likely have several helpful habits you carry out throughout your day. Did you brush your teeth today? Take a shower? Did you express gratitude by saying thanks? Or in my case, use the greeting good morning while on an evening jog. These are common behaviors done with little or no deliberation. They are habits. Diving into the hook model. Ready to learn more about creating positive user habits? Read on to gain a deeper understanding of the hook model, a simple yet powerful way to help your customers form habits that connect their problem with your solution. In the next chapters, we dive into each phase of the hook model. Along the way, I will provide examples you can use in the design of your own product or service. By learning a few fundamentals of how the mind works, you will increase your odds of building the right product faster. By progressing users through the four steps of the hook model, trigger, action, variable, reward, and investment, hooks form habits. Remember and share. For some businesses, forming habits is a critical component to success, but not every business requires habitual user engagement. When successful, forming strong user habits can have several business benefits, including higher customer lifetime value, CLTV, greater pricing flexibility, supercharged growth, and a sharper competitive edge. Habits cannot form outside the habit zone, where the behavior occurs with enough frequency and perceived utility. Habit-forming products often start as nice-to-haves, vitamins, but once the habit is formed, they become must-haves, painkillers. Habit-forming products alleviate users' pain by relieving a pronounced itch. Designing habit-forming products is a form of manipulation. Product builders would benefit from a bit of introspection before attempting to hook users to make sure they are building healthy habits, not unhealthy addictions. More to come on this topic in Chapter 8. Do this now. If you are building a habit-forming product, write down the answers to these questions. What habits does your business model require? What problem are users turning to your product to solve? How do users currently solve that problem, and why does it need a solution? How frequently do you expect users to engage with your product? What user behavior do you want to make into a habit? Chapter 2. Trigger. Yen, not her real name, is in her mid-20s, lives in Palo Alto, California, and attends Stanford University. She has all the composure and polish you'd expect of a student at a prestigious school, yet she succumbs to a persistent habit throughout her day. She can't help it. She is compulsively hooked on Instagram. The photo and video sharing social network, purchased by Facebook for $1 billion in 2012, has captured the minds and attention of Yen and 150 million other users like her. The company's acquisition demonstrates the increasing power of and immense monetary value created by habit-forming technology. Naturally, the Instagram purchase price was driven by a host of factors, including a rumored bidding war for the company. But at its core, Instagram is an example of an enterprising team, conversant in psychology as much as technology, that unleashed a habit-forming product on users who subsequently made it a part of their daily routines. Yen doesn't realize she's hooked, although she admits she regularly snaps and posts dozens of pictures per day using the app. "It's just fun," she says, as she reviews her latest collection of moody snapshots filtered to look like they were taken in the late 1970s. "I don't have a problem or anything. I just use it whenever I see something cool. I feel I need to grab it before it's gone." What formed Yin's Instagram habit? How did this seemingly simple app become such an important part of her life? As we will soon learn, habits like Yin's are formed over time, but the chain reaction that forms a habit always starts with a trigger. Habits are not created, they are built upon. Habits are like pearls. Oysters create natural pearls by accumulating layer upon layer of nacre, called mother of pearl, eventually forming the smooth treasure over several years. But what causes the nacre to begin forming a pearl? The arrival of a tiny irritant, such as a piece of grit or an unwelcome parasite, triggers the oyster system to begin blanketing the invader with layers of shimmery coating. Similarly, new habits need a foundation upon which to build. Triggers provide the basis for sustained behavior change. Reflect on your own life for a moment. What woke you up this morning? What caused you to brush your teeth? What brought you to read this book? Triggers take the form of obvious cues, like the morning alarm clock, but also come as more subtle, sometimes subconscious signals that just as effectively influence our daily behavior. A trigger is the actuator of behavior, the grit in the oyster that precipitates the pearl. Whether we are cognizant of them or not, triggers move us to take action. Triggers come in two types, external and internal. External triggers. Habit-forming technologies start changing behavior by first cueing users with a call to action. This sensory stimuli is delivered through any number of things in our environment. External triggers are embedded with information which tells the user what to do next. An external trigger communicates the next action the user should take. Often, the desired action is made explicitly clear. For example, what external triggers do you see in this Coca-Cola vending machine in Figure 2? Take a close look at the welcoming man in the image. He is offering you a refreshing Coke. The thirsty text below the image tells you what the man in the photo is asking and prompts the next expected action of inserting money and selecting a beverage. Online, an external trigger may take the form of a prominent button, such as the large "Login to Mint" prompt in the email from Mint.com in Figure 3. Here again, the user is given explicit instructions about what action to take after reading the email. Click on that big button. Notice how prominent and clear the intended action is in the email from Mint. The company could have included several other triggers, such as prompts to check your bank balance, view credit card deals, or set financial goals. Instead, because this is an important account alert email, Mint has reduced the available actions to a single click, logging in to view and fix your account. More choices require the user to evaluate multiple options. Too many choices or irrelevant options can cause hesitation, confusion, or worse, abandonment. Reducing the thinking required to take the next action increases the likelihood of the desired behavior.